know, if they do grooming, it's going to be basic.
Huh. Okay, yeah. So did she get in?
Yeah, she got in.
Yeah. Oh, well, good.
Yeah, not only that, but she's already accepted to Yale.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes. Coming up, one of our favorite interviews about the Bernie Madoff scandal and how it continues to fascinate and frustrate.
Not every parent will experience an empty nest.
A mother of an adult disabled son tells her story.
How far would you go to get your beloved pooch into the right doggy daycare? It's not easy.
And flying without an airplane, the newest craze for thrill seekers.
The name Bernie Madoff will forever be associated with evil, greed, and a symbol of epic financial fraud. For almost 4 years, Madoff has been serving a 150-year sentence for his role in masterminding a $65 billion Ponzi scheme. It left thousands of people destitute, and it destroyed Madoff's family. This seemingly ordinary man somehow pulled off the largest swindle in history. He got away with it for decades. Many of us are still fascinated with how he managed to do it and why.
Diana Henriquez led the coverage of the Madoff scandal since the day the story broke. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times. Through exclusive research and unprecedented access, she's the only journalist to interview Madoff twice in prison and continues to correspond with him via email to this day. Diana recounts almost every aspect of the Ponzi scheme and adds significant detail to the story in her book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Truth. Diana joins us on the phone from beautiful Hoboken, New Jersey. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. Delighted to be back again.
Diana, you've had access, as we said, to Bernie Madoff over the years. What continues to surprise you the most about this epic scandal?
I think the durability of his own insistence on the way he wants to shape the story. Barring some deathbed revelation, I don't think we're ever going to know for sure some of the key questions that still remain in my mind. I do not believe Bernie Madoff when he says this massive fraud did not start until 1992. I've got very solid reasons to believe it dated at least to the mid-1980s. Federal prosecutors claim that it dated back to the late 60s. We really don't know. Madoff sticks to his story, and actually is one of the things that we wrangle a little bit about in emails back and forth. He still is trying to persuade me that I'm wrong about that, but he has not done so. So he continues to try to shape the history of his fraud, and that surprises me. You know, what does he have to prove at this point, for heaven's sake? You'd think he would realize that he would actually gain more attention, if that's what this narcissist wants, by telling us what really happened. But that's not his story. His persistence in what I think is a fantasy version of his crime has been a surprise to me. I also have been a little surprised that he has continued to address the rest of the marketplace. I think I've been in email contact with him longer than any other reporter. In fact, I know I have been. But he does occasionally send out little missives about his ideas about the marketplace or his ideas about government regulation or his ideas about the federal fiscal bailout. And, you know, I sit there saying, does he really think that people want to know what Bernie Madoff thinks about how to regulate the marketplace? But he is in this little bubble down there in prison. So he's a durable ego, no doubt about that, a well-defended ego. I'm just disappointed myself that I haven't been able to push him more in the direction of finally coming clean on some of these key details.
Now, Diana, as you said, you've been in contact with him. Let's talk about that. You were the first reporter to be granted on-the-record interviews with him after his arrest and when he was in jail. And now, how often are you in email contact with him?
Well, we had a bit of a gap when he got annoyed at my refusal to believe when the fraud started. So we were in almost daily email contact for, a year and a half, and then a hiatus of about 4 or 5 months. And now we are back in touch again, and oh my goodness, there's at least 2 or 3 notes a week that go back and forth.
Diana, just give us a quick overview of the scandal and how the Ponzi scheme actually worked.
Sure. Well, a basic Ponzi scheme is pretty simple. It's a liar with a bank account robbing Peter to pay Paul, and that was what Bernie did. He attracted a coterie of wealthy investors who all thought that they were given special access to Bernie. I mean, everyone, it was like the velvet rope syndrome. Everyone thought that they were the only one let into the club. Bernie kept them neatly separated from each other. But he claimed to be pursuing a conservative, hedged strategy of investments that would never produce huge returns, but would produce very consistent, safe returns. That was his story. But in fact, he was simply taking in money from new investors and using it to pay those nice, steady returns to older investors who believed that he was actually investing their money. So that's how a Ponzi scheme works. The money you get from the new arrivals goes to pay off the old arrivals and then so forth. By the time the hammer finally fell and he was arrested on December 11th of 2008, his investors around the world thought that they had about $65 billion invested with Bernie Madoff. Now, this would have made him by many times the biggest money manager in the world. But, you know, they didn't know how big he was, but it all added up to about $65 billion. In fact, they had nothing. Absolutely nothing. He had simply been, you know, using the money to cover withdrawals, and when the withdrawals became so immense because of the financial crisis that he couldn't cover them anymore, his fraud collapsed.
Let's talk about Madoff the man. You visited him in prison, you know, you said, and you communicated with him via email, and you also saw him after his son, Mark, committed suicide a few years ago, and you found him a very changed man. What was he like?
Well, the first Bernie Madoff that I saw actually reminded me a lot of the Bernie Madoff I knew on Wall Street. I mean, I did not meet Bernie for the first time in prison. I had known him on the street as a result of my financial coverage. I mean, everyone knew Madoff's firm. It was a pioneer, a vanguard in electronic trading. And so I knew him. And when I saw him the first time in prison, I mean, except for the outfit, obviously, it wasn't his, you know, hand-tailored Savile Row suits. But it's, you know, he looked very much the same, well-groomed, crisply pressed uniform, polished brass belt buckle, shiny black leather sneakers. He looked like the same dapper Bernie Madoff that I knew, translated here into a prison environment, and he had the same demeanor: smooth, quiet, self-deprecating, just an enormous capacity to make you feel like he thought you were the smartest person in the room. Then when I came back 6 months later, and it was just 2 months after his son Mark had committed suicide, as you know, it was a particularly pointed message, that suicide. His son Mark committed suicide on the second anniversary of his father's arrest. I saw this person in khaki uniform across the way, across the room, maybe 20 feet away. I didn't recognize him. I thought maybe it was somebody doing some janitorial work. I got closer, and he turned to me, and I was stunned. He must have lost 15 or 20 pounds. His belt was pulled so tight that he had to tuck the end under to keep it from flapping down to his thighs. He was poorly shaven. His uniform was ill-kempt. One corner of the collar was turned up. One button on the shirt was unbuttoned, and he never even noticed it. It was shocking. Absolutely shocking. And although he would not talk about Mark, I pressed him as gently as I could. I couldn't really justify pushing him very hard on that tragedy. He wouldn't talk about him except at the very end. He had at that point recently seen a People magazine profile of Ruth Madoff, his wife. And in that profile in the magazine, they had used some photographs of Mark when he was a young boy with his mother. Madoff, just as he was leaving, said, you know, I saw that article. I so wish they hadn't used Mark's picture. And he choked up a little bit on that and then quickly left. I've been asked frequently, does he feel any remorse? Does he feel any guilt? Does he acknowledge how many thousands of people he has devastated, as you described? And I've got to say to those questions, I don't think so. Not really. Not anything that you would recognize as genuine remorse. However, he absolutely is torturing himself over what he has done to his family. He blames himself for his son's suicide. He misses his family desperately. And if anybody is in a position to try to pity a figure like Bernie Madoff, that would be what you would pity him for, is the destruction he's brought on the people he loved most.
We are speaking with Diana Enriquez, contributing writer for The New York Times and author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Diana, what type of prison is he in? Is it one of those country club type places?
Oh, no. I went down to Butner for my first visit kind of expecting that. I had to wend my way through the woods of coastal North Carolina to find it. It's a huge complex. There are actually four prison facilities there on this vast campus. Bernie is in a medium security prison with an exercise yard that is surrounded by two layers of 20-foot chain-link fence topped by razor wire with a guard tower rising up on the far corner. It is a prison. The cells are called rooms, but they are cells. They are locked down at night. He isn't eligible to serve that term in a less secure prison setting.
Diana, really quickly, you interviewed his wife, Ruth, shortly after her big 60 Minutes interview. And I have to tell you, I watched that interview, and to me, she did not come across as very likable or very believable. Did you find her sympathetic? I mean, how did you find her? What was she like?
I agree with you that interview was a terrible depiction. But what I saw was a terrified person. She has always been an immensely private person. She agreed to that interview to support her son Andrew and his efforts to market that biography, but did not want to do it and did it over her own lawyer's objections. And when I spoke with her the following weekend, I spent, 8 hours almost over 2 days talking with her. I met a completely different woman, a person of kind of an earthy humor, relaxed, very emotional. She started crying at several points during the interview, has a warm relationship with her sister and brother-in-law. I can guarantee you that if you spent the time with her that I did, you'd like her.
Diana, do you continue to believe that she didn't know about the scheme?
I do, and there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that surfaced after all this time that she did know. And I've looked. You know, when people say, oh, how could she not have known? You know, I have two answers. First of all, prove it. Number two, surely, with 28 million pieces of documentation in the hands of the bankruptcy trustee liquidating this case in the hands of the prosecutors who have continued to bring criminal cases, not one post-it note has surfaced that suggests that Ruth Madoff knew what Bernie was doing. Plus, she's a fairly unworldly person. You know, there's an innocent naivete about Ruth. I can't see Bernie trusting her with a fatal secret. I just can't. She would be, you know, likely to crack a joke about it at the wrong moment. She just is not that kind of Machiavellian mentality.
Well, darn it all, Diana, we have to go. We're out of time. But Diana Enriquez, author of Wizard of Lies, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes, and we'll just have to get you back.
I would love it. Thank you.
Up next, When an Empty Nest is Only a Dream, a mother of an adult child with disability shares her story. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
We babes often lament about empty nests. We've experienced our own children going off to do their own thing in life, and our homes became deadly quiet.
So we have conflicted feelings. We're elated that they've made it through those teenage years relatively unscathed. They've graduated from college and landed a job. Yippee!
Yet we miss them like crazy and all those days gone by.
But the reality is there are some folks who will never fully experience the empty nest. They are parents of adult children with disabilities. And as retirement years approach, their challenges, plans, and financial obligations are quite different. Joining us in our Washington, D.C. studios is Susie Deal. She is mom to 21-year-old Joshua, who has severe disabilities. Welcome, Susie, to our program.
Thank you very much.
Susie, we've been dear buds for years, and Barb and I are just thrilled that you're here and you've decided to do this interview. I know it's not easy to talk about, but this is really an important story to be shared. You and your husband, Monty, have a gorgeous family. You have two beautiful girls, and that Joshua is an absolute treasure. Tell us briefly about Josh and his particular set of circumstances.
Josh is 21, and he was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and he also has borderline autism. We didn't know that he was going to have Down syndrome when he was born, so we were a little bit shocked, but we pulled up our bootstraps, and we kind of dealt with it. He was okay right when he was born, but he went into fetal distress, and he had some other complications that caused him to be a little bit more disabled than most people with Downs. He went through the school system until he was 21 years old, and we had to maneuver through that. And now we are in what is called an open community program, where he is working in a sheltered workshop in our community.
Now, Susie, you spent years as a full-time mother, case manager, caregiver to your son. And as we know, it isn't easy and it wasn't easy. You're continually fighting for the best medical care and for the best educational opportunities for him. But you've told us that each stage of development is like going through another death with Josh. What do you mean by that?
Typically, developing child learns how to speak at a certain age. They learn how to walk and they continue to develop normally. But when you have a child with a disability, every time they miss a developmental milestone, you revisit that disability and you revisit the death of your healthy child. So it's a little bit different. You never really get all the way through your stages of grief.
Even like, you know, taking those first steps or holding a pencil
or graduation,
reading aloud or
right. Going off
things.
To college, writing their name.
Right. 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 Writing those essays, whatever. You know, how did you go about, because you've raised a great family, how did you go about balancing it all, raising normal kids, you know, while raising Josh?
Well, the girls helped a lot. We have a wonderful, supportive family in Hannah and Rebecca. We just did our best. You know, a lot of times when you have a child with a disability, it either glues your family together or it tears your family apart. We're lucky that Joshua kind of pulled us all together.
Susie, this, as you said, you know, your family pulled together, but we read the statistics and they're startling about divorces of parents with, you know, with the child with disability. So how did you and your husband cope with this? What brought you together?
I think that we just felt as though Joshua didn't ask for this disability and that, you know, it was something that, of course, we weren't planning for, but we just felt like we needed to provide for him the most productive future that he could possibly have.
Well, we know, you know, as a parent, our worst nightmare is that something would not be right with our children. I know, you know, one of mine, my little girl broke her arm and I was a basket case. But how did Josh entering your world, you know, how did everything change?
We were expecting our child to be perfect, for them to grow up and for to go off to college and for us to be empty nesters just like everybody else. When we had Josh, we just kind of had to take a different road and make different plans. So, you know, it's been a long process, but we've had a lot more involvement with all different kinds of doctors and specialists. And I've had to drag my daughters along everywhere that we go.
Well, Susie, are there support groups for parents with adult children with disabilities?
There are. There are lots of local support groups. We're a member of a very wonderful group, and all of the children are starting to grow up, and the parents are having to make difficult decisions about, you know, what the empty nest is going to look like for them as well.
Are there any good respite programs out there that allows you to just take a break?
There are respite programs. There's money that's available through like the county and the state. The problem is with the economy the way it is, a lot of that discretionary money is kind of drying up, and the money is being reserved for, you know, your child going to a sheltered workshop and the kind of support that's needed for that.
And Susie, as you said, your girls are grown. In fact, I hear you're going to be a grandmother, and they've moved away. But Josh, of course, remains a constant in your life. He's living with you now, correct?
Yes, he is.
Well, describe your empty nest, your version of an empty nest.
Well, normally when we want to go out for dinner, we don't really have too many spontaneous dinner engagements. We kind of have to always plan. In order to go out, of course, we need to have someone with Josh because he doesn't stay at home alone. And so we have to arrange a caregiver, and it can't be like a 10 or 12-year-old babysitter like a normal person of a younger child is. So it's a little bit more difficult because we always have to find someone that's competent. It costs a little bit more, and we can't be really spontaneous. We want to say, let's go to a movie tonight. We have to take Josh with us, so it has to be kind of a Josh-friendly movie.
And if he doesn't like that movie, everyone will know about it, right?
I'm sure.
Everybody will know.
An empty nest is not the norm for boomers caring for an adult child with disabilities. Our guest knows this firsthand. You're listening to The Two Boomer Babes, and you'll hear more from our special guest, Susie Diehl, when we come back. Stay with us.
Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day, I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the Two Boomer Babes with Kathy and Barb. We're continuing our conversation with Susie Diehl. She's the mother of an adult child with severe disabilities. Susie, before the break, we were talking about your empty nest. For many of us, you know, we're now able to just kind of get up and go and do whatever the heck we want to do and spur of the moment. And of course, for you, life is a bit different. How really has it affected your own social life?
We've made some new friends, and they don't really know Josh, and he's not comfortable with them. So we don't really feel comfortable, and I'm certain they don't either, bringing him along with us. So we kind of have to make arrangements. We have some very lovely, dear old friends that Joshua's been brought up with that are wonderful, and our children know
that. And I hope we're one of those.
Yeah. The children love Josh because they've known him since he was very young.
Thinking about the future, have you all considered the possibility of a group home for Josh?
We are working on that. In order for your child, once again, because of the way funding is going, and I'm not sure if it's this way throughout the United States, but in our particular community, in order for your child to go into a group home, you have to make them a ward of the state, and it's need-based. And so I've been told from my particular situation that my child will not be able to because he has two living parents and two living daughters. And so the need-based is when there's no one else able to care for the adult.
Susie, you look fabulous. You're a boomer babe. And so, you know, you're probably getting close to retirement. Are you very concerned about who will take care of Josh once you're older or maybe, you know, no longer here?
Yes. And my husband and I have discussed that extensively. We both of our daughters have expressed that they would like to take care of Josh. So,
and then, of course, you have to plan financially for that.
Right. How do you even start to do that?
What we have decided is that our entire estate will go to care for Josh because he will not be able to care for himself. And so, of course, we have to appoint someone to be his executor. And we're hoping that the group home situation will work for us because he needs a life, too. Now that his sisters are gone, he seems like he is very bored. He needs a life. But once again, because he is not socially the same place as most 21-year-olds, I have to arrange most of his play dates
right, like
I would a young child. So unless I arrange for a social life for him, he doesn't really have one.
And Susie, just out of curiosity, how much does a group home cost?
They say the price for one person to live in a group home is around $86,000 a year.
Wow.
Wow. I mean, how do people afford that? They don't, I guess, is the answer.
They don't unless you make your child a ward of the state or you have private funds.
Well, do you have any particular advice for those in your situation but who don't have estates, who don't, you know, have a, you know, a deep pocket, but they're caring for an adult child? What can they do? It's hard.
Yeah, it's really difficult. Like I said, a lot of us are facing it right now. And, you know, it's much more affordable probably to get care in the home on a regular basis. But hopefully, you know, the programs will continue to grow. And I mean, the government needs to realize that this is a basic need for Americans and that they really need to think about fully funding these programs.
And you're a very active group. I hear about it all the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Keep on plugging.
Suze, I love the story that Josh's middle school teacher had asked you one time about the girls and how the girls were doing. And just share with our listeners how you responded.
Well, you know, his middle school teacher, we hadn't seen him for a while. And, of course, he got to know the entire family. And so he said, well, how are Hannah and Rebecca? And, you know, I said, they are really doing great. I said, Josh has done a great job of raising them. It seems as though, and this is kind of across the board, but most of the siblings of children with disabilities are kind, compassionate, caring people. And I mean, my daughters are an example of that. They really are great people. And I think that Josh had a lot to do with it.
And I can personally attest to that. Suze, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. We certainly have a greater appreciation of what it means to be a boomer caring for an adult child with disabilities.
Up next, how far will you go for your pampered pooch? Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
For centuries, we humans have had unbreakable bonds with our dogs. After all, they offer companionship, security, and unconditional love. Plus, they make great exercise partners.
Now, our human counterparts provide all those things too. Well, most of the time. But how far and at what expense will we go for Fido?
Bob Morris is someone who will go the distance. He's an award-winning author and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Style section. That's where we read Bob's article about his rather stressful, not to mention hilarious time, trying to get his pooch accepted into an exclusive doggy daycare in New York City. He joins us by phone from Manhattan to share his experiences. Great to have you with us, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, Bob, we'll start out by saying your dog's name is Zoloff, which kind of says it all, doesn't it?
Yep, she's definitely a mood elevator.
Well, besides kind of crazy, what kind of dog is she? We're curious.
She's a long-haired mini dachshund. She's black and brown, black and tan. She looks like a push broom. Imagine a black
push broom. Sounds adorable, but I'm so glad you didn't name her Xanax.
Well,
or Prozac
too.
Bob, you were trying to get Zoloff accepted into the members-only Ruff Club, and that's RUFF in New York City. And did I just say members-only for a dog club?
Yes, it's a spa. You know, I'm sure everybody knows about dog spas now, and this one goes the extra distance. A lot of spas test dogs anyway, because if they're going to tear people apart, they don't want them. But in this case, they have a very long, hour-long test. You know, the dog doesn't have to jump through hoops and away, but she does. You know, they have to see if they can even have their collar removed or a leash put on without getting very fearful. They have to see if they are anxious. They have to see if they have toy aggression, which means You can't take a ball out of their mouth without getting bit, like that. So it's kind of like, I compared it in this New York Times article to getting a kid into preschool in New York City, which is also very, very difficult.
Well, tell us about Zoloft. And, you know, apparently she has a few issues.
I would love to tell you all
about
Zoloft.
And don't whitewash, Bob. Tell us the whole shebang.
Even though she is your daughter.
Listen, I say what everybody says, you know. She's a shelter dog, so we adopted her. That's everybody's excuse for bad dog behavior in this culture right now. When I got her, she definitely is a very, very alert barker, which is common to this breed of miniature dachshunds. Of course, anything that comes to the door, she goes wild. But on the street, the real problem is that she tries to puff herself up to look like a Rottweiler when she's about 2 inches big, and she growls this low, menacing growl at about half the dogs that go by. And these owners look at her like, what is this little ferret doing carrying on like this? But it's pretty embarrassing. I have to pull her back off the leash. I have to apologize. Sometimes I stand between her and the other dog. And I don't know what this is, but apparently it is common to the breed, although that sounds like a horrible excuse. And the dachshunds are like that. That's the worst thing, is that that's a total embarrassment, and it also freaks out people. And then the other thing is that when I've left her with friends overnight, she has sat by their front door for 8 hours waiting for me and refuses to eat.
Oh.
So that's a separation anxiety, and she has some kind of aggression issue that probably comes from being a Napoleon complex little tiny dog.
Tell us again about that intense interview. We really want to hear what goes on.
The truth is, the first thing is that the owners of this club, which is in the East Village, which is still a very trendy neighborhood, first they look you and the dog up and down, for starters, so I needed to be well-dressed. But no, I mean...
and Zoloft, too, I'm sure.
No, I mean, what happens is a handler, who I was shocked to see actually had a PhD in animal behavior. So we have a high-level, academically trained person, takes the dog, does some basic things like removes the collar, makes sure that she will even go off with her as a stranger, and then she takes her on a practice walk. And at that point, when this was happening, I got so freaked out seeing this stranger take this dog for a walk who can be a little, if you'll pardon me, bitch on the street. I went after her and I said, oh, please, you know, like, if she lunges after other dogs, I'm sorry, you know, blah, 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 you know, like making excuses. And this dog handler just looked at me like I was insane. And she said, you know, like, I think the problem might be you, not the dog.
Oh, how could that be?
Because she said that what happens is, and this is true, when I see her approach with another dog approaching, even if my dog Zoloft isn't growling, I kind of tense up on the leash. You know, like I get very tense and I pull her to keep her under control, and this dog handler said that it actually doesn't have the right effect because it creates more tension for my dog.
This is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes, and we're chatting with writer Bob Morse about the trials and tribulations of getting his dog into an exclusive doggy daycare. So, Bob, we are waiting on pins and needles. What happened? Was Zoloft accepted?
Listen, do you want me to just jump to the end? I will. I won't tell you about the, like, 45 minutes of testing her in a room with other dogs where I thought she was going to sit with her tail between her legs and, you know, or bite somebody. But instead, what I noticed is when I was out of sight and nowhere around, all of a sudden she was like a very well-adjusted little thing.
Well, that's like children. You know, you're just
like helicopter parents.
Yeah,
exactly.
But I mean, you're so happy as a parent, you know, for your human children that they behave in public. Thank God.
Yeah,
so it's the same with the dogs.
Well, she would never play at dog runs. I would take her to dog parks. She would sit on my lap or hide under the bench. And then suddenly at this spa, when I was completely out of sight, she turned out to be a decently adjusted little thing.
She likes her perks. I mean, she's at a spa, Bob. She better behave.
So come on, Bob. Was she accepted?
No, but at this spa, they don't do that. They're anti-coddling at this spa.
Oh. She doesn't get massages and pedicures and
manicures? Going to eventually... No, definitely no massages. That's not what they're about. They don't think that's cool. They think it's silly. Nobody's going to get any pink bows in her hair at this place. You know, if they do grooming, it's going to be basic.
Huh.
Okay, yeah. So did she get in?
Yeah, she got in.
Fantastic. Oh, well, good.
Not only that, but she's already accepted to Yale.
Congratulations. You must be very proud.
I'm very proud. I'm always very proud.
Bob, I just have to know, how much does this place cost?
Well, it's $149 for a membership. And then after that, it's something like $29 an hour or something. I think it's maybe $39 a day. I mean, that's what people pay for to board their dogs.
And then they're very politically correct, because don't they give scholarships and they have community programs for those less fortunate dogs?
Yeah, because, you know, like, the thing is, the last thing you want to be called in this day and age is elitist. I mean, that's as bad as not being sustainable. So, you know, I'm sure they're doing, like, programming. They're going to open themselves up for community programs. I mean, as you know, there are about 8 million organizations to save unwanted dogs and cats in this country, and, you know, there's rescuing from puppy mills, and so a lot of these organizations are based in New York, and so they do need a place to meet, so they'll do that, and they'll give scholarships, and I don't just mean to the movie stars who live in the neighborhood. No, I mean, they're good community people. They're okay.
How often does Zoloff attend her little academy?
To tell you the honest truth, I hope not very often, because I have learned how to sneak her in a Chanel-looking shoulder bag onto the airplane and onto the bus and all the places that I want to travel with her. So she basically stays by my side because I'm too neurotic to live without her.
Aww. Well, wait, I got to ask about that airplane. You mean you just put her in your pocketbook and you get on the airplane?
This is bag. Yeah, yeah. We've only been busted once.
Does she not bark or come out or anything?
Well, you know, the vet recommended half a Benadryl, and it really doesn't seem to be working. So, you know, this just happened. I got off a plane from Washington to New York, and, you know, like, she's on this plane whimpering and squeaking, and, you know, it's hard. But basically, you know, she wants out of the bag, so we have to figure it out.
Well, Bob, let me ask you, what do you think attracts people to these exclusive daycare places? I mean, are these all over the country? Are they in Boise, Idaho?
It's they want to go someplace that you're not allowed to get into.
Oh.
Isn't that so mean in New York of me to say?
Yes.
No, it's like the old velvet rope thing, you know? It's like, you know, if you go a little extra mile, a little extra distance, that you can have something other people can't have. I mean, it used to be that we were all, you know, we had frequent flyer models and miles, and we could get something out of it. Well, this is like actually a pretty smart business model, because, you know, for $150 a month, which, let's face it, isn't very much if you live in New York, you know, you have a staff that actually is going to some extra trouble to know the habits of your dog and, you know, have a personal relationship with you. Most of these dog spas, as cute as they are, you just drop them off and they throw you out the door. Mm-hmm. This place, you come in and you can socialize in a little coffee bar area that's quite attractive and hang out. So, you know, it's for children. These are, you know, for boomers, these, you know, a lot of our pets, especially single people, have become, you know, our children. And so it kind of does make sense in a way that there's a slightly more upbeat, friendly, you know, human-oriented environment to make you feel comfortable when you leave your dog.
Well, your article clearly struck a chord with readers and boomers, and we hear it was the second most emailed story ever in the history of the New York Times.
Oh, ever? I like the ever. No.
Ever and ever and ever?
No, that day. Every day there's another story.
Oh, okay. Gosh.
Today there's a story about cats that's, like, you know, way up there on the list, because it's this research is proving that they're totally killing a lot more birds and squirrels and little wild animals than anybody ever suspected.
But it just goes to show there's so many other crazy people out there like you, I guess, Bob, huh?
Crazy? I don't know. What is it? Something like 50 million dog owners in this country? But I am about to hopefully write another story, this time about the insane habit of dressing up my dog, because I like the attention that she gets me on the street. So that's a whole nother subject.
Author and New York Times contributor Bob Morris, this has been a hoot. Thanks so much for sharing your story about Zoloft with
you,
the two Boomer Babes.
You're very woofy. Welcome, Boomer Babes.
Up next, a new way to get your thrills, flying minus the plane. Stay with us.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, Visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate. Mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association,
you know,
and the Ad Council.
It's going to be basic.
Huh. Okay, yeah. So did she get in?
Yeah, she got in.
Fantastic. Oh, well, good.
Not only that, but she's already accepted to Yale.
Congratulations. You must be very proud.
I'm very proud. I'm always very proud.
Bob, I just have to know, how much does this place cost?
Well, it's $149 for a membership. And then after that, it's something like $29 an hour or something. I think it's maybe $39 a day. I mean, that's what people pay for to board their dogs.
And then they're very politically correct, because don't they give scholarships and they have community programs for those less fortunate dogs?
Yeah, because, you know, like, the thing is, the last thing you want to be called in this day and age is elitist. I mean, that's as bad as not being sustainable. So, you know, I'm sure they're doing, like, programming. They're going to open themselves up for community programs. I mean, as you know, there are about 8 million organizations to save unwanted dogs and cats in this country, and, you know, there's rescuing from puppy mills, and so a lot of these organizations are based in New York, and so they do need a place to meet. So they'll do that, and they'll give scholarships, and I don't just mean to the movie stars who live in the neighborhood. No, I mean, they're good community people. They're okay.
How often does Zolof attend her little academy?
To tell you the honest truth, I hope not very often, because I have learned how to sneaker in a Chanel-looking shoulder bag onto the airplane and onto the bus and all the places that I want to travel with her. So she basically stays by my side because I'm too neurotic to live without her.
Aww. Well, wait, I got to ask about that airplane. You mean you just put her in your pocketbook and you get on the airplane?
This is bag. Yeah, yeah. We've
and
only
does
been
she
busted
not,
once.
Does she not bark or come out or anything?
Well, you know, the vet recommended half a Benadryl, and it really doesn't seem to be working, so... You know, this just happened. I got off a plane from Washington to New York, and, you know, like, she's on this plane whimpering and squeaking, and, you know, it's hard, but basically, you know, she wants out of the bag, so we have to figure it out.
Well, Bob, let me ask you, what do you think attracts people to these exclusive daycare places? I mean, are these all over the country? Are they in Boise, Idaho?
They want to go someplace that you're not allowed to get into.
Oh.
Isn't that so mean in New York of me to say?
Yes.
No, it's like the old velvet rope thing, you know? It's like, you know, if you go a little extra mile, a little extra distance, that you can have something other people can't have. I mean, it used to be that we were all, you know, we had frequent flyer models and miles and we could get something out of it. Well, this is like actually a pretty smart business model because, you know, for $150 a month, which, let's face it, isn't very much if you live in New York, you know, you have a staff that actually is going to some extra trouble to know the habits of your dog and, you know, have a personal relationship with you. Most of these dog spas, as cute as they are, you just drop them off and they throw you out the door. Mm-hmm. This place, you come in and you can socialize in a little coffee bar area that's quite attractive and hang out. So, you know, it's for children. These are, you know, for boomers, these, you know, a lot of our pets, especially single people, have become, you know, our children. And so it kind of does make sense in a way that there's a slightly more upbeat, friendly, you know, human-oriented environment to make you feel comfortable when you leave your dog.
Well, your article clearly struck a chord with readers and boomers, and we hear it was the second most email story ever in the New York in the history of the New York Times.
Oh, ever? I like the ever. No.
Ever and ever and ever?
No, that day. Every day there's another story.
Oh, okay.
Today there's a story about cats that's, like, you know, way up there on the list because it's this research is proving that they're totally killing a lot more birds and squirrels and little wild animals than anybody ever suspected.
But it just goes to show there's so many other crazy people out there like you, I guess, Bob, huh?
Crazy? I don't know. What is it? Something like 50 million dog owners in this country? But I am about to hopefully write another story, this time about the insane habit of dressing up my dog because I like the attention that she gets me on the street. So that's a whole nother subject.
Author and New York Times contributor Bob Morris, this has been a hoot. Thanks so much for sharing your story about Zoloft with
you
the two Boomer
woofy.
Babes.
You're very woofy. Welcome, Boomer Babes.
Up next, a new way to get your thrills, flying minus the plane. Stay with us.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Barb and I are not among them, but some people have dreams of flying. And we're talking about flying without a plane. For those thrill seekers, there's a new sport out there called wingsuit flying.
James McDonald, otherwise known as Macca, is head of marketing for Phoenix Fly, the makers of wingsuits. Macca is an avid wingsuit flyer himself. He joins us on the phone from merry old England to shoot the breeze with the babes.
Hey, delighted to be here, and hello, babes.
Macca, describe the wingsuit for us.
To look at it looks a little bit strange. If you imagine kind of like a set of pajamas that were joined in the middle that had sort of fabric between the arms and the legs she kind of look a bit like a flying squirrel. That's kind of what a wingsuit looks like.
And are they custom made? I mean, do they come in small, medium, and extra large?
They're absolutely custom made. We take sort of very sort of specialist measurements of the people who wish to buy them, and we make them absolutely custom to that individual because of the requirements of how they fly. They've got to fit pretty snugly.
So you just kind of zip them up and jump?
Pretty much, yeah. We obviously still use a parachute system to ensure that we can sort of do it more than once. But otherwise, yeah, we zip the suits into the what we call a rig, which is sort of like the backpack that contains the parachutes. And then you put the whole lot on and you go flying.
Okay, so where do you jump from? Is it buildings and towers and mountains? I mean, is sky the limit, literally?
Pretty much, yeah. There's sort of two kind of ways of doing wingsuit flying. You've got the skydiving way, just like normal skydivers. You go up in an aircraft up to about 13,500 foot, and then you exit in your wingsuit, and then you fly around, usually with other people, build some formations and things like that, and generally have a lot of fun in the sky. Or the other kind is base jumping, which you kind of mentioned there. We wouldn't necessarily do it from buildings. We tend to need a little bit more height than that if we're going to base jump. So it tends to be from the sides of sort of mountains, really.
And how long can you stay airborne?
To give you a bit of an idea, a regular skydiver, someone who you might see in the movie who comes out and flies on their belly down towards the earth, from about sort of 13,000 foot, that skydiver would get about 55 seconds in free fall if they deploy a parachute at the sort of the average height, which is about 3,500 foot. In a wingsuit, we can get roughly about sort of 3 minutes plus from the same altitude. So it's kind of value for money. You're tripling your free fall time.
Well, Mac, I really hope you offer lessons.
We do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm an instructor and examiner. So not only do I teach people how to fly wingsuits, I teach people how to teach people how to fly wingsuits. So.
Oh, wow. You're a real muckety muck. Well, now, how much does all this training cost?
Depends on the coach. Some coaches charge. It's usually only a sort of a minimal amount, say, you know, $50 to $100 or something. But some don't. I don't charge if I'm teaching students, because for me it's the reward is sort of seeing the smile on someone's face when they exit the aircraft for the first time and open their wings and actually realize that they're flying. It's a real difference to regular skydiving.
This is like the last thing I'd ever do, Mecca. If I had my last wish. But tell me, how dangerous is this sport? Has anybody died?
Again, if you split it up between skydiving and base jumping, in skydiving, no one's died from a direct result of sort of a wingsuit related, accident. It's pretty safe. Skydiving in general is relatively safe. The gear is very well tested nowadays, and people are very well educated in sort of where the risks and things are. In base jumping, however, we've lost quite a few people, and quite a few people who are very, very experienced at it as well.
Oh, gosh, lesson learned. I say jump out of the airplane. Well, Mecca, if I want to do this for my husband, how much does a wingsuit cost?
Wingsuits, they sort of range anywhere between about, I'm trying to think of the dollar price here, but in UK pounds, they're sort of about 600 to 1,000 pounds. So I guess that's roughly about $1,000 up to about $1,800, something like that.
Okay, we hope you'll give the babes a discount.
Of course.
Mecca McDonald, Marketing Director of Phoenix Fly and avid wingsuit flyer, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the two Boomer Babes.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much to all you at home for joining the two Boomer Babes. Hope to see you next week, same time,
same station. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.